Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Did you get out into the night sky this past week to take a look skyward and check out the Perseid meteor shower? Pretty awesome show, wasn't it? I didn't have a very good vantage point, as you might imagine, too much light in the skies above Las Vegas, but I did get to see a few wisps of streaking light. And I got to see a whole bunch of videos and photos sent by friends and photographers all over the Northern Hemisphere. Events like the Perseids tend to help us connect with the universe and to remind us that we're all part of something much larger, something much more wondrous than ourselves. It's also humbling to know how big the universe is, how small we are in comparison. And you can't help but ask, where do we fit in? Do we have any role at all in the big scheme of things? The big question, of course, are we alone? As the saying goes, if we are alone, it sure seems like an awful waste of space. If you listen to this program on even a semi-regular basis, you know where we stand on that question, and I am hardly impartial myself. Tonight, we jump into the deep end of the cosmic pool and take on those very questions, the biggest ones of human existence. But this will be a lot more than a sort of rhetorical exercise. We're going way beyond the mere theory that someone else might be out there. We'll take a first-hand, up-close look at the possibility that not only is someone else out there somewhere, they've been here or are here on a regular basis, interacting with us in a way that goes so far beyond the stereotypical tale about alien encounters, abductions, contact, missing time. You know all that stuff. I read a book this weekend, unlike anything else in this genre. It's the story of a lifetime of contact between a New Zealand woman and other species, other entities. Susie Hansen's story goes way, way beyond the typical alien encounter. It delves into origins, language, intentions, long-range objectives of these visitors, and the many, many people on Earth who, she says, have developed relationships with these others. Susie's story would be more than enough all by itself, but coming along to talk about her experiences and to help us put them into sort of an understandable framework is a giant of the scientific world, as mainstream as a scientist can get. Dr. Rudy Shield is an astrophysicist, long associated with the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He not only has followed Susie Hansen's story, but he's lent his name to her book, along with running scientific commentary about the events therein. The book is called The Dual Soul Connection, subtitled The Alien Agenda for Human Advancement, by Susie Hansen with Dr. Rudy Shield. And Susie will be joining us. That title should tell you it goes far beyond, you know, the run-of-the-mill alien encounter account. She joins us in hour two. We'll be here all night. Dr. Shield will, I think, join us in hour three and stick around as well. He might be even joining us earlier than that. We're going to figure that out here soon. And you will have a chance to speak with both of them later in the program. So get your questions and comments ready. Before that, we're going to have some fun with zombies. Not real zombies, of course. As far as I know, the only zombies that exist are in TV shows and movies and comic books. But we've all been deluged with zombies for several years now. They're everywhere. The success of the TV series The Walking Dead, which I guess I've seen the promos for it. It's got a spin-off series. It's starting soon. It's got us all thinking about zombies and the zombie apocalypse. There's a store here in Las Vegas. I think it's called The Zombie Apocalypse. It sells survival gear aimed at that kind of an event, though I suppose this kind of gear will also come in handy for a run-of-the-mill end of the world as well. How might you do? How would you fare if this came to pass? Could you handle it? How far would you go to survive? A new book of essays looks at different aspects of a post-zombie world, the psychology of a world overrun by walkers, the living dead, Travis Langley edited the book. It's a fun read, whether you follow the TV series or not. And he will be joining me in just a few minutes. We're going to dig way down deep into the zombie psyche, or more to the point, how humans might cope with that kind of stress. Just what you always wanted to do, right? On the Coast to Coast website tonight, webmaster Tim Binal has posted the hot story of the evening about the discovery of the plague at Yosemite National Park. A couple of squirrels confirmed with plague. That can't be good during the height of the summer visitor season. Tim and I have also put together our usual assortment of odds and ends and oddities culled from all kinds of news sources around the globe. We call it Naps News. You can find it there on the Coast website. Among the items tonight, a rarity. You ever wanted a peek inside the top secret off-limits Area 51 military base? And who doesn't? It's a place where all manner of spooky stuff, CIA monkey business, has unfolded over the years. Tonight, you get a look. Some film footage, recently declassified, now available. As you'll see, it was shot years ago, and you won't see any flying saucers hidden in hangars inside this stuff, but it does give some cool glimpses of what it must have been like to work out there. Check it out when you get a chance. Also on our Naps News list tonight, a look at the man for Mars. Man for Mars, Elon Musk, who has big plans for the red planet. A new book is out about Musk. Also a profile of another man known for deep thoughts, John Keel, the ultimate paranormalist and explorer of the unknown. We got a new piece about him, as well as a scientific finding about Neanderthals and their unusually large eyes. What's the reason for these big eyes? Did those eyes contribute to the extinction of this species? A few other items I know you're going to want to read when you have a moment. While you're there checking out Naps News, take a look at how to become a Coast Insider. It's a good deal. Pennies a day gives you access to a vast library of previous programs and archives, interviews. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on whatever device you want. With that, let's get to it. You know the drill. Put on a pot of Joe, bring in the dog, feed the cat, slip into those jammies and slippers, plop yourself down in that Barca lounger, and turn up that radio, because here we go. Back in a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Travis Langley, PhD, is a professor of psychology at Henderson State University. He's the author of Batman and Psychology, A Dark and Stormy Night, spelled with a K. He's also written Star Wars Psychology, Dark Side of the Mind. He regularly speaks on subjects of heroism and popular culture at psychology conferences, but also at fan conventions like San Diego's Comic-Con and at universities throughout the world. He writes a column online for Psychology Today, and he's written a new book, The Walking Dead Psychology. It's a heck of a lot of fun. Welcome to the program for the first time, Dr. Travis Langley.
Hey,
good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's awesome. It was a lot of fun. The book is a lot of fun. I'm just wondering, let's start this way. Why the fascination, the enduring fascination with zombies? What do you make of it?
Yeah, why all the zombies? I saw someone had a statistic the other day that one-third of all zombie movies have been made in about the last 14 years. So we've got this 21st century boom in them. Of course, it depends on what you mean by zombies anyway, because until Night of the Living Dead, that word was not used for this kind of creature.
Right.
These were ghouls, classically. In fact, they weren't even using the word in Night of the Living Dead. This emerged with fans over the following years, and then Romero started using it himself. Why these particular creatures? There's so many reasons, and I was a fan of The Walking Dead long before it was on television. I read the comic book from the first issue. It's the only comic book where I ever had letters published in the letters column in the back as I'm going through analyzing things and thinking about why Rick would still be alive after a month in a coma in that hospital. It's like, well, there's obviously a nurse somewhere who might have been in trouble once Rick let the zombies out. But
there's a line in the introduction, which is John Russo, the co-creator of Night of the Living Dead, the yes. classic Night of the Living Dead, wrote the foreword to your book. And there's a chunk in his introduction that says, to talk about why the interest in zombies, because zombies are fun, somebody says. You get to shoot people without them really being people. And I think that's part of the attraction, isn't it? Wow, it sure would be fun to kill some zombies.
Yeah, that part was actually my introduction. Yeah, John and I, John wrote the foreword, I wrote the introduction. Yeah, that particular thing right there was from a conversation that I had with Robert Kirkman, creator of the comic book, and Frank Darabont, who developed the TV series, I was asking them, why zombies, why now, as opposed to some other time? And they were making comment that, things were getting so much worse in the modern world, and the horror fiction had to become more horrible and depressing. And then Darabont weighed in with, but it's also fun, zombies are fun. And, I said, you get to shoot people without them being people. And Darabont was, with impunity! He was just so excited as he was talking about it.
Well, it's kind of like in video games where you can kill people with impunity, right?
Yeah, and we do see a growth in this kind of fiction in a lot of different ways. But why zombies as opposed to so many other things? Why not vampires? Vampires used to be human beings as well. But with vampires, they retain some kind of character. Zombies usually are written where the personality is gone, the person's not there, and among the many different things that are going on, it reflects our own concerns about our loss of humanity. That's been there through the entire history of the world. People used to worry about, what if something steals your soul? What if, this person that has been bewitched? In this modern era, in the 21st century, what if you're losing your soul to the internet? What if you're not having social interaction because you're caught up in that phone? In this busy, hectic world that we're living in, you worry about yourself losing your humanity or the people around you losing their humanity. And zombies, they're touching on that, because these were people. They're not people anymore. Or are they? It even gets in there at times in the series where some of the characters are discussing, well, how do you know that they can't be cured? And to those of us who watch it goes, well, we know they're zombies. Of course they can't. But from the character's point of view, it's not a stupid question.
Go ahead. Sorry. I was going to say about the book, The Walking Dead Psychology, up in the top in the corner, it says unauthorized. Were you, walking a fine line to be able to write this thing? Are the producers of the TV show okay with it?
Well, you have to be careful when you're talking about something unofficially that you're not reprinting, direct text from theirs without a good reason. And personally, I don't really want to do an authorized text because it kind of narrows you. You have to limit yourself to what is okay with the company. Like if you're going through talking about Star Wars, you can't gripe about Jar Jar Binks the same way if Lucasfilm has to approve what you are or aren't saying.
Right.
With The Walking Dead, you have to be careful where you're not reproducing an entire scene in the text just for the character. We have freedom of speech. We have the freedom to talk about something. But in any case where we're quoting, from the direct source material, we got to have a reason for saying that. I'll even go that with the people writing chapters on this sometime, where it's like where they have several lines in a row where they've talked about the story. It's like, why are you giving that detail? Do we need to use that? Keep these things in mind so that, troubles won't arise. Because, there are other unofficial books. There's a Walking Dead, and there are two different Walking Dead and philosophy books, and there's Triumph of the Walking Dead, other books of essays that are out there. These companies that are making these, they know, they deal with people. Although some will, like Lucasfilm and Disney, and there are others who are known for pursuing people who are violating their copyright. So you do have to keep in mind, what are we talking about and why? In this case, we're not telling original stories with these characters. We are not reproducing scripts. We are talking about The Walking Dead.
Well, talk to me about, as a psychologist, what we learn from this. What does the popularity of this series, of this genre, of this theme, what does it tell us about ourselves? I'm sure you got a long laundry list of answers to that, but what is the answer?
Well, so, why the interest in a post-apocalypse? Why this particular post-apocalypse? And why is it zombies? The human race is conscious of its own existence. We are conscious of death and the possibility for ourselves. We know our own mortality in ways that other species do not act like they are aware of it. This has always been on our minds. And how does the world itself end? For thousands of years, people have speculated on that as well. Apocalyptic tales, Norse mythology, Odin and the other Norse gods, they were more mortal-seeming than other mythology's gods because they spent time worrying about how to delay Ragnarok, how to
Ragnarok,
delay the
yeah.
end of everything.
Right.
And in our day and age, you know, we've got several generations of people who've grown up conscious of the possibility of World War III. Now in the 21st century, we've got new scares. We've got, you know, manufactured viruses and other things that make us fear the possibility of everything ending or everything changing drastically. You know, someone could release an engineered virus in the world. It would not necessarily wipe out the entire human population. It could reduce it to a very small number of people. Now, in terms of ongoing fiction, watching a story every single week about a very realistic-seeming scary virus is a bit too uncomfortable. And so with something like zombies, that additional level of fiction where you know that can't exist, it lets you think about those same issues, but with a little bit of a more comfortable distance. It's what I call this filter of fiction that lets me talk about some of the worst things in the world. You know, when I'm teaching forensic psychology, I can talk about, you know, individuals who have seen their own families get murdered, and this really happens, and we do know some things about them, but that's a very unpleasant topic. I can talk about it with a fictional character, though, and somebody who would have been turned off by the reality of it will listen to the same psychology, the same lessons, but with this fiction. In The Walking Dead, we know, at least most of us know, there's not going to be a zombie apocalypse. We might worry about some other kind of apocalypse. Yet why isn't it an alien invasion? There are good alien invasion stories. There have long been alien invasion stories. The alien invasions, two things. One, well, you're going to have more people who do worry about an alien invasion than a zombie apocalypse. And two, those aliens did not used to be us. The zombies used to be us. And so that touches more personally on that, back to that fear of the loss of humanity.
A lot of people would, I don't want to get down on preppers because I'm a semi-prepper myself. I mean, I prepare for, yeah, I don't know, a disaster or something, a couple of weeks without
right.
power or something like that. I get the feeling sometimes preppers want an apocalypse to happen just so they could say, I was right, you guys are wrong.
Yeah, you watch some of them talking about these things, and I've watched, I don't remember which one of these shows. My wife does not want to watch these things because she doesn't want to hear the preppers. I find them interesting, and the kind of reasoning they've got. But there are a few who, they'll say, yeah, they've gathered all these things, neighbors are making fun of them now, but the tone of their voice when they say, but just wait till things go bad and they come around to me, as if it,
Yeah, I don't
right,
make fun of
wrong.
I don't I wouldn't make fun of people for preparing for disaster. I think that's pretty smart. I would poke fun at people who hope that it happens, though.
Yeah, it's that hope that it happens. Preparing for it is realistic. My dad has always talked about, you know, be prepared. It's like things could go wrong. I think that's also part of why The Walking Dead works. It's set in the South in a rural environment, where you're going to have more people who, whether they're planning for an apocalypse or not, they are prepared for, you're going to have more hunters in the rural environment than in some other settings. So more people who are prepared to, you know, fight, you know, not just the gun culture, but, you know, they're more prepared to, you know, live off the land as well. You'll have more farmers, you know, people with, you know, more of the kind of skills that might be worthwhile in that sort of environment. The preppers, the ones who are looking forward to these things, I think some of them, it's the same sort of thing that makes us, a lot of us, wonder about these. It's like, sometimes it would be nice just to have a worldwide do-over, you know, where you don't have to worry about those credit card bills anymore, you don't have to worry about, you'll have new worries, but it's still a fresh start. And the idea of a fresh start has its own appeal as well. And
absolutely.
That'll be another thing on that laundry list of reasons people are interested in this.
And and concerns about technology, how technology mm-hmm. is taking over and getting away from us, the idea that a world could start over without all that stuff would be appealing to some, including me.
It is hard to imagine how we can possibly get away from some of the repercussions of the technology. You know, Stephen Hawking and other very intelligent people have said, you know, we really need to slow down on some of this technology because artificial intelligence could be truly dangerous, you know, if we get to it too quickly.
We're talking with Dr. Travis Langley about the walking dead psychology. When we come back, continue the conversation and sort of figure out how tough it would be on the human psyche to go through something like this. I think a lot of people would crack, and you can't talk about zombies without the zombie. She's Not There from 1965. We'll be back in a moment with Coast to Coast AM. The great John Fogerty's written so many mega hits that this one from 1986 kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Eye of the Zombie, it's called, and you can figure out why we're playing it tonight. We're talking with Dr. Travis Langley, the editor of The Walking Dead Psychology. Pretty interesting look at the various aspects of how we might cope with the zombie apocalypse. When we come back, we'll talk about the psychological pressures, what it would be like for the survivors. Those who try to hang on in the face of something as terrible as this. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. One of the essays in the book, The Walking Dead Psychology, is by Colt Blunt, and he quotes Nietzsche as saying, "He who fights with monsters should be careful lest he thereby becomes a monster." And the chapter opens with this quote. I thought it was a pretty good line. "Many people see the possibility of a civilization crippling zombie apocalypse as the perfect opportunity to become the ultimate badass." I mean, Travis, there's no question a lot of people at home are sitting there thinking, boy, that'd be a lot of fun. I could do that. I could hang on to that.
The big old video games. There are other horrible things that you can't think, well, that would be fun. You know, nobody wants to imagine. It's like, yeah, I think I could fight those Nazis well, you know, if I were in the Holocaust. You know, nobody's doing that. You know, this zombie thing that you know can't happen, you know, lets you have those fantasies. And it's a safe fantasy because it doesn't intrude in what we could really have to do. You don't wonder, it's like, could I pull everything together? Of course, also people go, no, if that could happen, I'd be in trouble. I'd be dead in the first 24. In fact, a friend of mine said that today. She said, I'd be dead in the first 24 hours.
I've seen these projections of where it would be. You've probably seen the map of where you don't want to be when a zombie apocalypse breaks out.
Yeah.
In cities, right? Yeah.
Yeah, one of those maps I was looking for, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm in a pretty good area. And you know, and then there are my relatives over there with the cabin and the guns. That, oh, yeah, they're in a really safe spot. Low population density. In the southern U.S., as long as you're in an area that's not heavy population density, because they figure into factors like gun availability into these things. Of course, that can also make your fellow human beings dangerous, too. I know some people go on this new series that's set in L.A., you know, are they going to fare better there than the people do in Georgia? Because there are guns in L.A. too. Yeah, but those people in L.A., they're not using those guns, you know, in terms of the same kind of hunting. So, yeah, there are a lot of different factors. I do know the maps you're talking about, and I'm in a pretty good spot there. I teach at a university in southern Arkansas. It's a liberal arts university that supports creative ways of teaching, using things like Batman and zombies to teach real psychology. I am very fortunate in that regard. And also, yeah, we're far away from any, you know, the major cities if a big crisis happened, or, you know, the targets if World War III got launched.
You know, you can't help but sit and strategize how you would handle it. You know, what doors would be barred, how much food you'd need to hold them off. But there are consequences, I would think, and the book gets into it, that people don't think about, is that kind of constant stress, the constant threat outside the door would really wear on you, wouldn't it? As a psychologist, how would you say, how would it work for most people?
Yeah, I think that's part of why the show has an appeal to combat veterans, you know, because they've gone through situations in which they've had ongoing relentless stress or random stress when you never know when the trauma will happen. And that itself gives you a steady stress. And for some of these individuals, they come back home and other people in their lives eventually, you know, just wish they would get over it and, you know, be back in the thick of the rest of social interactions, but it's not that easy. This zombie apocalypse story, you know, gives them a conversation piece that lets them open up with some others. Like this past season, you know, the television series got into issues of well, what's it like for people who've been through the relentless stress and the frequent trauma, who then wind up in a town that has been protected from the apocalypse? This town full of people who haven't been going through these things, and they're living everyday lives. And the characters, the main characters, show a variety of reactions. There's one in particular who everybody's going, oh, she's just the perfect example of post-traumatic stress. Although, technically, it has to be at least 30 days after the trauma. But barring that, she's showing you a full range of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. There's another character, Carol, who she has grown in many ways over the course of the zombie apocalypse. She's also showing a full set of PTSD symptoms, but she's doing it in a different way, not as obviously. And that's one of the things about this fiction, lets us talk about, you know, something like post-traumatic stress disorder is not exactly what most people think it is, and it comes in a variety of different forms. Some people in a horrible, stressful situation will emerge and have their best qualities come out. Other people, their worst qualities will come out, and we don't always know ahead of time who that's going to be. You know, there are people who are so cynical, go, I would never stick my neck out for anybody else, and then in a time of crisis, they do exactly that. And then
Carol.
There are those,
yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, and then there are those who oh, yeah, I would do the right thing, and then they turn coward and freeze up. Because you don't know until you're in the horrible situation where people talk about the fight or flight response, but it's really fight, flight, or freeze. And you don't know till you're in the situation which your brain is going to activate.
Just like in combat, I guess.
Yeah. You can't know for certain who's there. You know, the people, it's like this person, he's the leader in basic training and goes out into combat and might be able to handle the crisis just well or might collapse on the first day, whereas someone who is doing poor in basic training may emerge as the hero. Until they're there, you don't know. And so we don't know those things about ourselves. We don't know that we would be heroic. We don't know that we wouldn't. So it lets us have that fantasy.
Seems to me, and you're the book, one of the chapters addresses it, the idea of survivor's guilt. There'd be a lot of people that feel bad that they made it.
Yeah, that is a normal kind of thing. You know, you see people in some of the worst places in the world or times in history or maybe not even that large a scale. You know, you had a house fire. Some members of the family got out and some did not. Even if there's no logical reason for the guilt, you know, if you didn't do anything to cause what happened, it is still a normal human reaction to feel some survivor guilt, you know, to feel guilty that you survived when somebody did not, you know, that, you know, maybe you feel you didn't deserve to survive, or for it to gnaw at you, wondering what you could have done differently. And that is a hard thing. You can't just say, get over that. You find a way to move on in life. You know, sometimes hanging on to that guilt, sometimes the survivor guilt does not go away, but some individuals are able to take that and use it in a constructive way. Or survivor anger. You know, someone like Candace Leitner, whose daughter got killed by a drunk driver, you know, in her anger over the light sentence that drunk driver got, you know, she made her form of Batman's childhood vow, you know, to wage war against drunk driving, and she founded what was originally called Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. And she did not let it go. She held on to it more than average, but she found something constructive to do with that, somewhere to channel, you know, those feelings of frustration over what had happened.
Do you find the characterizations generally accurate? Yeah, this makes sense. That's how people would react. Yeah, I could see a character acting like this. In general, as you watch that show, does it seem to ring true with you?
It does for me. I think that is a big part of its appeal as opposed to some other zombie story, why someone else's zombie story was not the one that became the ongoing television series. I know this past year, when some of the characters had gotten separated, one of the characters, Maggie, did not know what had happened to her sister Beth. She did not know if Beth was alive or dead. And I saw people discussing that on the internet. It's like, why isn't Maggie talking about Beth? For some of them, it didn't seem to ring true, but to me it did, because there are plenty of individuals who won't talk about the thing that's going to bother them the most. They will avoid thinking about something like that. They'll avoid talking about it, because once you talk about it, you then have to let all the other feelings associated with that just collapse in on you. And as long as she did not say, "I wonder where Beth is," she did not have to talk about the fact that she didn't think Beth was alive. Because in that particular case, acknowledging that her sister might be dead also meant acknowledging that the last person she knew before the apocalypse was gone. So avoidance is a very common thing. Avoidance reactions are common for some people. People handle stress in so many different ways, and I love the variety of what we see in these characters. To me, it rings very true, even when somebody seems to be acting wrong. People act wrong in real life all the time.
You had mentioned about Carol, and what I know about the series, I mean, I remember her in the early going. She was almost like an abused woman or coward as a wife, and was kind of subservient, and she's getting stronger as the series has gone on, it seems like. I don't know if a person could really do that. I suppose some could.
There are abuse victims who go on to be leaders in opposing abuse. You know, there are individuals who have become strong leaders in anti-abuse organizations or campaigns who had those things in their history. And it is hard to believe, hearing them now, that that was ever in their history. So even that with Carol, to me, it's like it's not everybody. It's not the majority of people. But there are people who do make that kind of growth. So these people that we're seeing on the show, they are exceptional individuals who have managed to outlive the majority of the human race already. So we're not necessarily talking about the average person or the typical person with all of them. We're talking about some unusual individuals. In Carol's case, she's definitely got some of that survivor guilt, you know, because of, you know, family that she has lost along the way. And she won't talk about her daughter. You know, just like Maggie would not talk about whether her sister might or might not be dead. Carol will not talk about her daughter. It's just, for her, that's something she has to avoid, or she'll collapse.
Seems like if you were to survive something like this, suddenly the zombies stop coming, and you know Rick and the gang hang on and are able to live through it, they're never going to be the same. It would be sort of like survivors of a nuclear war, nuclear winter. The horrors that you see, you know, you physically survive, but you're not going to be the same people, not the same humans that you were before.
No, in the post apocalypse.
Yeah.
No. You get changed. You see the individuals who've gone through war. You know, if you ever talk to relatives who've been through combat, some of them won't talk about it. You know, I had a great uncle who had gone through just terrible things back during World War II. You know, saw a friend killed right in front of him and was there in the foxhole for a while afterwards. And, you know, he was never the same for the rest of his life. A fine man, a very nice person, but, you know, he was never the same as he had been before. Patrick Stewart, who played Captain Picard in Star Trek, he has talked about the anger he's had toward his abusive father, but he's also heard from other people that his father had been different before war. War changed the man. Now, not everybody's going to be changed in that direction. Even people who they change and become stronger people than they were before, they're still not the same. No. You can't just go back. You can't unlearn everything you've gone through. It stays with you regardless.
One of the chapters deals with becoming a sociopath. What does this show teach us about the nature of sociopaths? I know we've got a lot of them. They're not always easy to spot.
Yeah, that show, in terms of the issue of the sociopath, they raise a lot of issues of, well, what is good and evil, who will become better, who will become worse. Of course, that word sociopath, there's no standard definition for it. As it tends to get used, it means someone who has acquired the qualities of a psychopath, you know, someone who doesn't have a conscience, somebody who doesn't have the same emotions about right and wrong that the rest of us do. And in some horrible situations in the world, like you're in a combat situation or you're suddenly living under a brutal regime, there's some people who kind of numb themselves to their own better qualities and stop listening to their own consciences. The character Shane in The Walking Dead, you know, he takes an interest in his best friend's wife, but while they thought the best friend was dead, and he reaches the point that he wants to kill his best friend. You know, he set someone else to die, and these are things he was not doing before. He has been changed by these situations. So some people, it's very rare for ongoing traumatic situations to turn an adult into a sociopath, for it to be an abrupt sort of thing. There are individuals, but it's not that common. Fiction kind of overrepresents this. You know, movies, TV series, comic books, they love having the villain who was a regular old guy until this one horrible thing happened, then he becomes this insane mass murderer. That doesn't happen. Mass murderers are grown over the course of their lives, not just suddenly turned on one day.
And then the whole idea of killing, I guess, you know, people thinking, well, I could do it. I could do it if it came to it. But it probably is a lot harder than you think, even if it's a zombie. And as a corollary to that, before you comment, I mean, you know, a lot has been written by folks in your profession about the dehumanizing effects of video games, whether it makes it easier for young people who get used to killing 1,000 zombies or aliens all day long, where it makes them easier to kill humans and not think twice about it. Does the same thing apply to a show like this? Uber popular, incredibly popular. You see it every week, or you binge watch it. And does it? I know zombies aren't exactly human, but they used to be human. Does it have an effect?
Yeah, it's like, you know, in fiction and in real life. You know, within the fiction, you know, shooting the zombies would inoculate you a bit to the stress of shooting a real person. This is something. Another thing we learned from soldiers. You know, it can be difficult to train a soldier to overcome the resistance to killing someone else. There are those who've gone through all their training, they get out in the field and they freeze up. Some of the training, therefore, involves shooting at more human-like targets to get them to overcome that initial resistance. And you could then make the argument, well, video games are doing some of that same kind of thing, stimulus response. The arguments make some sense, but the evidence doesn't back it up the same way. For example, just one of the many signs, if you want to look at like the rate of violent crime and how that compares to video game sales, the sales of violent video games is actually higher when violent crime is lower, which we don't know what it means. That's just a correlation. Maybe it means there's a cathartic effect and they're taking out their aggression in that video game instead of against real people. Maybe it means something else. But in terms of the evidence to back up that these are training people to go out and kill, it's not there as clearly as some people want to argue.
So the evidence for a TV show desensitizing would be even less then?
Of one TV show doing it,
yeah.
Things is about but repeatedly viewing it, then we know you get less sensitive to some of the details. We know repeatedly viewing, you know, stories about violence that aren't sensitive to the victims make people even less sensitive and less concerned about victims. So it does depend on the depiction. You know, in this case of the kind of story we're talking about, they are humanizing the victims. They're showing pain. And that sort of thing has actually been shown to increase empathy among viewers.
You see any signs of zombies going away anytime soon? I mean, the show is still popular. There's a spin-off series. There's so many movies. We had a big rash of vampires for a couple of years. Seems like that's kind of petered out. This zombie seemed to be going strong.
It's big. I don't see it happening anytime soon. It is hard to imagine. How can you keep telling lots of new stories with this? I asked George Romero that several years ago, but before this TV series came around. It was commenting about how we had seen so many stories where, you know, there's a zombie outbreak, people hold up, they learn the rules. You know, why do we keep seeing this same basic story? And Romero said, well, he wasn't interested in the story himself as to what you're saying about people. And you can use this to say many different things about people and interactions, and it could potentially be as diverse as people themselves. Like, for example, okay, why is so much pornography popular on the internet? you could easily go, well, okay, you've seen one undressed individual, you've seen another, why does somebody need to see 50,000? Well, it doesn't exactly go away, does it? So potentially, with the variety of characters and the variety of people, you could put so many of them in these situations too.
All right, Travis Langley, thanks. The Walking Dead Psychology, it was a fun read, and I think the fans of the show would get a kick out of it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, coming back with Susie Hansen and her amazing story in the Dual Soul Connection. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.